This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from The New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week, we're going to be talking about the film Jackie and the BBC thriller Appletree Yard.
Anna has also watched Silicon Valley for the first time, so she'll be telling us how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. We've been going through the emails, as we are wont to do. We have an email from Alana who says that she's a long-time listener, first-time recommender.
Love it when people say that.
Me too. So she says, this is probably a tiny bit left of field, but I'd like to recommend a podcast series that's basically a radio play, but zombies.
good.
She says she liked it because she's a big fan of sci-fi, and it's called We're Alive, A Story of Survival, which follows a group of survivors of a zombie apocalypse in downtown LA. She said it was a great way to liven up her commute and that the story is told through diary-style entries in which each of the different characters are writing dramatised scenes like a radio play. The first series or so is a bit up and down in quality, but overall it got me hooked and the latter series are great. So that sounds really fun.
That does sound really great. Actually, podcast format audio drama is something that I'm only just really getting into. I mentioned in one of the podcast columns I wrote for the New Statesman website a while back that it was a bit of a kind of blind spot of mine. And people have just been sending me their stuff ever since. And yeah, it's really, really good.
Great. Well, I hope to get involved with We're Alive.
We've also had an email from Joanna, who is picking up on something that we mentioned last week from another email. And this is this Norwegian drama. Now, I don't really know how to say it. It's S-K-A-M. So Joanna says it rhymes with the English sum.
So scum.
Scum, I think, must be it.
Maybe.
But anyway, Joanna says, I've held off tweeting you about it because I thought everyone else already had. Nope, just the one other person emailed us. It's become huge, particularly in Sweden and Denmark, as well as Norway, but really throughout Europe, people of all ages seem to like it. I was late to it, but I was blown away, despite it being so hyped. And then she just addresses some of the points that we mentioned and why she liked it. She said, the social media is handled so well. So this, if you remember from last week, the show is made up partly of video and partly of, you know, interactions between the characters, Instagram and Twitter accounts and stuff like that. It's a kind of multi-platform drama. She said it's handled so well. It's one of the best parts of the show. It's so real. And a large part of the characters' lives actually happen in the text messages. So I guess this is just like an epistolary novel, isn't it? You know, but in TV form. Said the writer's a genius and it's done really similarly to Skins. Each season focuses on one particular character. So that's really interesting. She said it's shot really beautifully, reminding me of some films like Blue is the Warmest Colour, really close and slow and intimate. And said it's about girls and friendship.
I mean, I really want to watch this.
Yes,
I also had a friend get in touch who's Norwegian saying that she just really, really recommends it. But we've hit a stumbling block, haven't we?
Which is that we don't speak Norwegian.
And we don't know how to watch this with English subtitles.
So yeah, Scum fans out there, please can you tell us, or ideally send links. How do we watch this?
Can you just link us? Because we don't know how to do it. You know, we're happy to pay. We just want to be able to see it.
Oh, and while we're asking you for favours, like free links to Norwegian TV shows, we would also like to ask you a big favour, which is to go on iTunes, if that is where you listen to your podcast, and write something nice in the review box. You all write such nice things when you write to us about how much you're enjoying it. So if you could just write some of them on iTunes. That would really, really help us find some new listeners and maybe get featured.
Yes, thank you to the best listeners in the world. So, moving on.
The first thing we're going to talk about this week is Jackie, which is a biopic starring Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy, and it follows her life after the shooting of her husband, US President John F. Kennedy, in 1963. It's directed by Pablo Larraín and also stars Peter Sarsgaard, Greta Gerwig, and John Hurt.
People like to believe in fairy tales.
You ready?
Of course.
And you?
I believe that the characters we read about on the page end up being more real than the men who stand beside us.
I found this film intensely stressful to watch, but also interesting. So I often struggle with a film that covers a very, very well-known historical event. Mm-hmm. I either find myself really bored because I think, well, I know what happens, he's going to die. Or I get really caught up in it like it's a thriller and I forget that the person's going to die and then I get really sad. In this case, I veered more towards the boredom option.
Mm-hmm.
I think partly because it's the way the film's been made. I found it to be quite like dream trance-like, which I think is supposed to reflect Jackie's state of mind and the kind of fugue state that she ends up in. But there was one pivotal moment that I thought really made it stand out, which was the way it really showed you the visceral horribleness of what it's like to be in a car next to someone getting shot. All those shots of the car like speeding towards the hospital with her, with his like blood all over her face. And you know, it's a political event we've heard so much about, but actually I've never heard about what it was like to basically sit next to a dead man.
Yeah, they sort of save that stuff for towards the end of the film, because it's quite hard to have momentum, as you say, in a film where you know that what's going to happen. And this is one where they sort of play around with chronology quite a lot. So you open with a journalist who's clearly come to interview her about these events. And towards the end of the film, we revisit the times when JFK was president and that, you know, Jackie was really happy. And so they play around with that a lot. And that means that they can save some of those really dramatic scenes to show you them in full in that really unfiltered way towards the end. But I agree with what you say, that this is more a film about a woman's state of mind than it is a film about political events. It sort of goes behind those iconic images that we've seen, like Johnson being sworn in while Jackie stood there in her bloodstained pink Chanel suit. It goes behind those really iconic images to explore how she was feeling rather than to explore the sort of political turmoil going on at the time.
Yeah, and that is, I think, it's a necessary thing because it is such a well-trodden bit of history.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, they had to bring something fresh to it, and calling it Jackie and making it a look inside her mind was the way to do that. I did also really like how they'd meticulously gone for the iconography of it, in the look of it. So all of her clothes and a lot of the poses, you know, of like her walking down the plane steps are so recognizable because of the photographs or the footage that you've seen. And that was a really good way of like jolting you into realizing that you were seeing behind those images.
The lighting and the coloring is so that 60s look of the time. There's a lot of playing around with aspect ratio and other things in this movie to try and make you feel like you're sort of either there at the time or looking at the photos at the time or watching the live TV footage. There's lots of like, you know, filming of people watching TV.
Or filming people filming things actually as well. Yeah,
exactly. I haven't seen Pablo Larraín's other stuff, but he did a film called No, apparently, in which they worked really hard to use actual footage from the period that they were depicting and getting the actors and the scenes to integrate as seamlessly as possible with that actual footage of the time. And although I don't think they've done any of that here, the fact that I'm even saying I don't think shows how well they sort of integrate some of those bits of documentaries with Natalie Portman as Jackie showing all the work she's done on the White House. That feels like they could have used a few shots from a real TV documentary and laced them into the format, because they've worked really hard on making that seamless. And I think that really pays off in terms of locating you in that time.
Yeah, I agree. What did you think of Portman's performance?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I mean, it's so difficult in a film that is about what someone's not saying, essentially, which is a lot of what this film is about. And they anchor it with this interview that Life magazine did, which was a very short interview. and really centered only around, you know, two or three long quotes from Jackie. And then years later, he donated his notes from that interview to, you know, a JFK library. And when you look at the notes, there's so many notes. They're all available online, and I would recommend reading them next to the Life interview, because clearly so much was said. And you also get Jackie's own notes on top of his notes, so you can see how she's helped shape the interview. So that at the end of the film, you sort of see her annotating his notes, and it feels like a bit of artistic license, but that is something that happened. So it's really difficult as an actress, I think, to pull off like, oh, this is about what she didn't say at the time and what was going on in her head. But I think she does it as well as it can be done. You know, there's no special acting tricks that say, oh, this is what I'm really thinking, here, you can see it in my face. But you do get a sense of this, just like this onslaught of grief and trauma and the changing of her mind about the funeral. And it's, yeah, I think it's really well done.
And you do also get that really, what I think of as a very Natalie Portman thing of incredibly contained energy. She is really good, like I'm thinking of Black Swan and stuff like that. She is really good at seeming like she's almost vibrating with something whilst not actually moving. I did think she you know, translated that really well into grieving.
I liked her accent as well. My boyfriend said that he found her, you know, when she addresses her daughter as Caroline, said he found it very like Emily Gilmore's Lorelai.
Oh yeah, it is similar.
It's
actually
that similar sort of, but like rich, not Atlantic, but like, you know, all over the country American accent.
But it's also, I think that's accurate given where Lorelai Gilmore is from. Like that is roughly Kennedy land, you know. That is the right place, I think. So yeah, I can't say that I massively enjoyed watching this film, though, because it's quite traumatic. And
it is.
Yeah, as you say, you are supposed to be immersed in her grief, which is obviously not a fun thing.
One thing it made me think of was the relationship between like grief and beauty, which I feel like is something that I think about when we, another thing that we discussed on Seriously, the Year of Magical Thinking.
Yeah.
And these two women who are so iconically beautiful, Joan Didion and Jackie Kennedy, both in that sort of like intellectual way, that quotes classy way that we think of. And they both obviously have suffered great traumas and great periods of grief. And there were some moments in this film where you see, like, you know, her in that pink Chanel suit that's covered in blood, and she's walking and she's little, and it's so hard not to be like, wow, that's just a beautiful image, even though you know that it's all really about death. And why do we make those connections in our minds between death and beauty?
I thought that as well, with all the shots of her like rippling black veil and stuff, where, you know, she just looks, it's objectively a beautiful piece of cinema. I actually recently read the follow-up to A Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion called Blue Nights, which is about, so if the first book is about the death of her husband, the second book is about the death of her daughter, who died about 18 months after her husband, after being in a coma for a long time and never really recovering from various brain surgeries and stuff. And there's a part of that book where she talks about aging and, you know, grief and age going together. And she frames it through like the clothes that she will never wear and never wear again. And she talks about, I think they're red velvet sandals with a 4-inch heel or something. And she kind of equates the realization that she'll never see her daughter again is the same as the realization that she'll never be the person that wears red velvet sandals with a 4-inch heel again.
And there's that moment in Jackie where she comes out and her child says, why are you dressed funny, Mum? And she says, well, this is what we wear when very sad things happen, and a very sad thing has happened. And I don't know why I thought about Joan Didion in connection with Jackie, but, you know, Jackie also lost her two of her children as well as her husband. And there's just something about those figures of grief that are meant to be beautiful that struck me. I also really love the score to this film, which is by Mika Levi, and I've been listening to it for like a month since before watching the film. And it's so layered and clever, and it's sort of that very grand, slightly orchestral, very occasional sort of music that you would expect for this sort of film, you know, like period White House. But it's got this real note of horror to it, like the, you know, the blood splatters on a very formal dress or suit, and then you've got these like very, you know, horrible kind of like whining strings that are quite bitter. And yeah, I love that combination. Again, good sort of ambient music. But there was a great piece over at MTV, we keep mentioning MTV at the moment because they're doing lots of great writing, by Hazel Kills, who sort of analyzes the soundtrack and why it fits the movie well, which we'll put in the show notes.
Did you have the feeling while you were watching this, I did, that whilst this is a film I would watch at any time of year, obviously this has been released very much with like a tilt at the awards, you know, big biopic, actress like pulling out an amazing performance, etc. But I don't think it's going to do very well, do you?
I mean, it's hard to tell. It's not going to capture people like La La Land has, I don't think, because it's quite nuanced and sensitive, and it's quite hard to be like, this is what the film is about. It's quite hard to sum up its impact in an easy way, and it probably doesn't play to the Academy in the same way. So I don't know, really. One thing I noticed, and I wonder if you noticed this, there was a part played by... Well, there's a role in this film which is just like some security guy who was present during the shooting, who is like saying to Jackie, you know, oh, we can't have, I'll talk about the funeral arrangements and whether we can have this. And, you know, I heard the two shots and blah, blah, blah. Do you remember that he like is in sort of the room when she's got her children around?
Oh, vaguely.
And he's like very chiseled.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you spot the actor?
No.
Jack from Silent Witness.
What?
Played as like a White House security... Yeah.
I didn't clock that at all. I was just like, security guard man. Like, he's barely in it.
Yeah, so people who watch BBC programming like Silent Witness might be shocked to see a staple of our viewing have a cameo in this movie. It was a very small part, but it gave me great pleasure nonetheless.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is Apple Tree Yard, which is a BBC adaptation of a thriller novel from Louise Doughty, starring Emily Watson as Dr. Yvonne Carmichael, who is a scientist who goes to give some evidence at a select committee meeting at Westminster and meets a tall, dark, handsome stranger. And therein, the drama develops.
The only person I can talk to about you is you.
Have you seen the chapel in the crypt?
You're married. So am I. You saw me. I really think you did. And I saw you.
Excluding 10 minutes at the end, which were quite horrible, this is basically a sex romp. Yeah. This makes you sound like a Sun columnist.
It is. And it's funny, actually. So I was Googling this morning trying to like just see what other people had thought of it and stuff. And I found this amazing article on the Daily Mail, which I think prior to it airing had written a kind of like, apparently there's 10 whole minutes of sex in this hour-long programme type article.
The Sun like counted up minute by minute, and then I think lots of other publications followed suit.
So they followed that up this morning with, people actually didn't find it that sexy. And then it just embedded loads of tweets from people saying like, oh, they haven't got much chemistry, have they?
That's really funny. I found it very sexy, I have to say. It's quite like, so it's the story of a, you know, middle-aged woman having an affair with a middle-aged man who we assume is also married, but we don't really know anything about him. So it's not like crazy, youthful, tantric, like, you know, pornographic sex. It's like, should we be doing this? The thrill is the taboo, public place, toilet, alleyway sex. But I don't know, for me, I still really enjoyed it. I found it something, it's quite like mumsy erotica, but I just found it quite fun.
So, yeah, there's quite a lot of interspersing of the mundane with the sexy, right? Because the first time when they're doing it in the cupboard,
we have to talk about this in more detail. We can't just say in the cupboard.
Oh, right, so it's the cupboard. It's the cupboard in the House of Commons where Emily Wilding Davidson hid herself so that she could be counted on the census as part of the suffragette movement.
So if you're British and you've ever like gone to see the Houses of Parliament on a tour, the like coolest bit of the tour is if they decide to take you to the crypt, and it's like a beautiful gold chapel and it's like hidden underneath Westminster Hall. And then the like, you know, cool thing about that chapel is that there's a cupboard where, as you say, Emily Wilding Davidson spent a night and was able to register her address as the House of Commons so that she might be able to vote. And Tony Benn, a British MP, put a plaque up about it. So this is, it's really funny, and he like uses this to like seduce her. He's like, have you never seen the chapel in the crypt? And like comes back with keys, and meanwhile her husband is texting her about nose drops, and she's like, ugh, Gary with his drippy nose. And then like this guy like takes her down into the chapel and shows her the cupboard, which is like a brilliant move, because it's like, hey, attractive woman, come with me, a strange man, into this broom cupboard where I shall show you what a great feminist I am.
Yeah, it is. It is like A plus.
Exactly.
Like, it's like woke so man seduction.
Yeah, it's like literally the least feminist thing you've ever seen in your life. And then they bang in front of Emily Wilding Davidson.
They bang in front of the ghost of Emily Wilding Davidson. And at some point she like kicks a mop over, bucket over. And it's all very like, yeah, this like layering of the ridiculous and the sexy. I have to say, I did not find this show sexy. You did.
Just me.
I did not. I know, I think lots of other people on the internet did too, but I didn't. But that's partly just because I don't, as a rule, find TV sex that sexy, especially not when, basically the stress that she was feeling about maybe getting caught, should she be doing this, all I felt was the stress.
Just the anxiety.
Yes. So the whole time I was watching this, I felt very anxious about her getting caught and ruining her otherwise quite okay life. You know, fine, her husband has a drippy nose, but he seems okay otherwise.
He is much more attractive. So her husband, yes, Gary, is the villain in New Blood. Who was like quite sexy in New Blood.
He was.
He is just a very sexy man. And the affair guy, visually not as handsome, so I would really like it if they had cast these roles the other way around.
Yeah,
and then I would have like fallen for the spy
I also
character a lot more.
Think that, yeah, so the guy that she's banging in cupboards and stuff, we assume is a spy.
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know because we haven't read the book, and there's only been one episode, because he won't say what his job is. He just sort of vaguely implies that he's in the civil service and then doesn't really tell her anything about his life,
and keeps saying that it's very boring, which is a thing that people with exciting jobs do to like let you know that their job is exciting. They're like, oh, it's so dull.
Yeah, so that was a moment of implausibility for me, because I felt like someone as like smart and cool as she is would not just accept that this man's like, oh yeah, I've got this boring job that I don't really like to talk about, let's bang. Like, she'd be like, no, what is your job? What actually is your name?
But like, she quite likes it, doesn't she? She's like turned on by the fact that he might be a spy. Anyway, so as you can probably tell from the way we're discussing it, there's not much of a plot in the beginning. It's just like a lot of her meeting up with this guy and having sex.
Yeah.
And then it all takes a sour turn, right?
Yes, there's a rape scene.
Yeah, so we won't go into between who or how it happens, but I really don't know where it's going to go from here. And obviously we haven't read the book, but I assume that a murder will happen soon.
A murder has to happen because we did see, is it at the beginning, or we saw a flashback to her, like, in a security van being driven across Westminster Bridge.
I've also heard this book described as a courtroom drama.
So she must, I think she, there's definitely going to be a murder of some kind and she must be arrested for it then. We can say that much. But it's another one, actually, where, like, the chronology is a bit unclear and it, like, circles round itself a lot, which I think, you know, it's all part of the what I've heard called chick noir, actually. I know apparently that's like Gone Girl and Girl on the Train, and I
why
guess
can't it
this
just
as
be
well.
Noir with a woman why no, does no. it have to be chick noir
I know, but so I feel like manipulating time and unreliable narrators and stuff is a trope of
these books yes.
And so that this is definitely something we've got here as well. Having said that, I didn't find it that sexy. I did think Emily Watson was really good.
Yeah, she's very easy to watch, isn't she? And that sort of, like, you're not sat there like, I mean, there's no reason to compare this to Jackie other than we were just talking about it, but you're watching Natalie Portman play Jackie and you're thinking, how good is she at this? Like, no. Whereas Emily Watson is just always so easy to watch. You just forget that you're, like, watching an actress. It's just very...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I did several times, like, talk to the screen and say, like, don't talk to that guy, he's clearly a weirdo, you know, because I felt like I could communicate directly with the character. You know, you lost that feeling of there being an intermediary. So this show also had echoes for me of another slightly shit spy drama of, I think it was on last year or possibly the year before, called London Spy. It starred Ben Whishaw and Charlotte Rampling. So this show promised so much. So it stars Ben Whishaw as a kind of Jim Broadbent was in it too, a slightly hopeless, like, 20-something gay man living in London, working in a horrible, like, Amazon warehousey type job. And he just one day out on a walk meets this amazing guy and they really fall for each other and they're really happy. He's called Alex and Alex lives near him. And
I think I can know what the twist is coming from the
yeah
title.
So then one day Ben Whishaw goes around to Alex's house. He's not there. He can't find him. He's not answering any of his phone number, phones or anything. And eventually Ben Whishaw discovers a creepy sex attic, radical departure from creepy sex dungeon. It was in the attic. And he's poking around the creepy sex attic and he's like, wow, we never did any of this stuff. Like, he never even mentioned he was into any of this. And then gradually he realizes that Alex is dead in the suitcase.
Oh.
Like, looking at him the whole time. Yeah. And then the whole rest of the show is just Ben Whishaw trying to find out how someone he thought he knew so well could have this whole...
could have a creepy sex
other
attic.
Life. Well, yeah, and then no, it all gets very complicated and basically Alex is a spy and all this stuff.
So it reminded you of...
It reminded me strongly of that, in the frisson of, like, sex with a spy being the centre of the show, but then also the style of thriller where you're kind of placed in the head of a protagonist who doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, you as the viewer don't get any privileged information in this. You find out things when Yvonne does.
Yeah. No, that's definitely, and that's, yeah, as you say, like, part of this whole group of novels and so on. I'm definitely going to keep watching. Definitely want to know where it's going because it's just withheld enough information for me to keep me interested.
Last time, I recommended Anna watch the HBO sitcom Silicon Valley. Anna, what did you make of it?
So this is a program about tech nerds in Silicon Valley. As you can tell from the way I'm introducing it, a lot of this was lost on me. I didn't understand what they were talking about a lot of the time. And I think part of the problem sometimes that we have with recommending each other TV shows is that you can only really watch one in the week. And the first episode is really setting a lot of stuff up. There's a lot of, like, tech speak about like different people's startups and what they do and why they might be valuable and how much value one thing might have versus another that I just didn't understand. But, you know, they do enough for you to let you know as the audience that he's stumbled across a $1 billion idea that he doesn't even understand. He's tried to make one thing and in the process has invented something that's actually a lot more valuable for corporate purposes. So yes, they do enough to explain it to you, but I just felt like I was dealing with that more than I was thinking about how do these characters relate to one another? Where's the humor coming from with these people? And I'm sure a huge failing of the first episode is that there is not much Jared, who is your favourite. He has quite a small part in this first episode.
Yeah, so I feel like it is definitely a kind of front-heavy show in that they do a lot of the heavy lifting, like setting up what is what and establishing the parameters of it in the first episode. It kind of calms down a bit after that and becomes a lot more of a sitcom of like five guys in a slightly shit house trying to start a company. And as soon as you get into that more confined space, I think you get more like inter-character relationships and stuff. And so Jared quits his job at the big company, I think in the second episode, to come and work with them.
Oh, I see. I wasn't expecting that.
So he becomes this kind of, well, because he's very like subservient and helpful, and he transfers his allegiance from like the big boss at the big company to Richard, the guy who's accidentally had the great idea. And so Richard's just perpetually baffled by why Jared keeps asking him permission to do things. And Jared keeps asking him, so like, Richard, should I write the business plan? And Richard's like, yes. And I just find his like constant desire to help and everyone else's constant forgetting that he exists really endearing.
That's cute.
There's also later on in the first series, someone offers him like a lift back from a meeting in their self-driving car, and the self-driving car drives itself into a shipping container, and then the shipping container gets shipped off to some like man-made island out in international waters because that's where the car is supposed to be delivered to or something, and he's trapped there for 4 days.
Oh god. Oh bless Jared. So yeah I think perhaps it doesn't have its best stuff up front, this show.
Yeah, it definitely gets more dramatic. The laughs come faster later on, I think. I just watched the season one finale over the weekend, which, again, it does still retain some of what you're saying, though, about the over-techiness, because the season one finale is set at this big tech conference where they have to present their, like, beta version of their app, and there are other apps, and someone, like, basically gazumps them and presents a better version of their thing before they present their thing. And then overnight, Richard, again, completely accidentally, doubles it. And like whatever he said he could do in a certain amount of time, suddenly he can do it in half the time. And everyone like wets themselves because this has never been done before. But as you can tell, I'm talking about some very vague terms because I don't understand what it is.
And I'm sure it's quite like science fiction-y. If you actually knew what you were talking about, you'd be like, no, hang on, this is bollocks. Yeah. But I don't know enough to say those sorts of things. Can I controversially use this segment of the podcast to ask you, have you continued watching Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
I've kind of petered out a bit.
Whereabouts are you?
Maybe 12 or 13 episodes.
Okay. I'm on the second season.
Oh, wow. You've overtaken me then.
Basically, Greg, the actor Greg, leaves.
What?
And so, like, literally, what are we meant to do now? It's so annoying. So they're, like, really trying to force the, like, Josh elements of the storyline. Because Greg, I feel like Greg was so clearly endgame.
Yeah, now they've
like, shafted Greg. So I'm, like, left, like, what is the shell of the show that I'm watching? Bring back Greg. Anyway, just wanted to interrupt your regular programming to say bring back Greg.
Okay, update on a previous recommend. I'm not happy.
Anyway, so for you next time, I thought we'd return to the idea of doing some short stories. So Fen by Daisy Johnson is a collection of short stories that I have been recommended so many times by so many different people. So I thought the recommend section might be a good opportunity for us to maybe tackle that one together. What do you think?
That sounds really good.
Okay, good. Because we enjoyed the last short story collection we did on Seriously.
I did. And I mean, I very rarely not enjoyed a short story when I'm given it, but I just don't seek them out. I never think to like browse collections of them when I'm looking for a new book.
Okay, cool. So let's pick some short stories to read from Daisy Johnson's Fen, and we'll get back to you guys next week. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, including in iTunes, where you could leave us a rating and a review. It helps other people find the show.
You can get all our back episodes on seriouslypod.com. We're going to announce more events very soon, so make sure you go there and sign up for our newsletter so you're the first to know when tickets are on sale.
Also there on the website, you can find our specials on Home Alone, Gilmore Girls, Harry Potter, Love Actually, and Friends.
We're available many other places places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr, with SRSLYpod on all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the show.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.